Anarchist Bastard was the name Judge Thayer called these two good men. I'll tell you the prosecutor's name, Katzman, Adams, Williams, Kane. The judge and lawyer strutted down, they done more tricks than circus clowns. Two good men's a long time gone. Two good men's a long time gone.
What you're listening to is Woody Guthrie singing about Sacco and Vanzetti. Sacco and Vanzetti on this day in history, August the 23rd. Sacco and Vanzetti were executed in 1927. They were anarchists who were accused of a robbery and murder in Boston. They was much like in those days, Panthers and others during the 60s and during the revolutionary period here in America in the 60s, where people thought they had to stand up and fight, some of them. And there was a huge controversy. There was a huge movement built around Sacco and Vanzetti. And Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti were both executed on this day in 1927. That was part of this day in history. The other parts of this day in history, let's talk about some births very fast. Keith Moon, who was a drummer for the Plastic Ono Band and The Who, was born on this day in 1946. And Rudy Rediger, the football player that the movie was made about, Rudy, was born on this day in 1948. This was a day that the very controversial inventor, Philip Emma Gwali, was born in Akure, Nigeria, 1954. River Phoenix, who died in 1993, was born on this day, the actor. And Jeremy Lin, the Harvard phenom basketball player, was born on this day in 1988. Artie Lang, who is one of the most interesting psychiatric thinkers in our history, formed the anti-psychiatry movement, was born on this day in 1989. His book's well worth reading, especially on schizophrenia. This is the day that Barry Bonds was born. The father, Barry Bonds, was born in 2003, born in 1946. This is also the day in 1784, there was a state that was created called Franklin that took parts of Tennessee, with mountain people saying we want to have the right to our own state, not to be ruled by the plantation bosses of North Carolina, created their own state for a brief period in America called Franklin, and that was on this day. This is also the day, interesting enough, in 1861, that James Stone was the first black man to fight in the Civil War. James Stone passed for white, joined the army, and enlisted in the first flight in artillery of Ohio. Nobody knew he was white until a year later on his death in battle. And they found out that he was actually a black man who volunteered early to fight in the war. This is the day in 1900 that the National Negro Baseball League was founded in Boston by Booker T. Washington and others. And Booker T. Washington became the first president of the Negro Baseball League. This is the day in 1908 that 52 nurses led by Martha Franklin for the National Association of Colored Nurses organized to improve the status of black women in nursing in America. This is also the day this is a very significant day in our history. There was a race riot that took place, we call a race riot, in 1917, and it's called the Houston Riot. It involved the 24th Infantry Regiment, which is a black regiment, and white citizens and police officers in Houston. The police went into the black Houston neighborhood and shot guns and stormed to this woman's house, dragged her out half-clothed in front of her five children, beating her and getting ready to arrest her, when an infantryman from that unit came up and asked what was going on. And they beat him and arrested him. Then another soldier came to the prison to see what happened to his fellow, and they beat and arrested him as well and shot him. And then another soldier in that regiment was killed. So when the soldiers were called to muster, the black soldiers in that regiment decided, look, we've had enough of this. We're not mustering. They went and got their guns, and they marched into Houston with their guns to defend the black community from the police. They were met by a mob of whites with guns and the police. A battle ensued, in which four police were killed, four army soldiers were killed from that regiment, and another 20-40 people were shot and killed in that battle as well, black and white, that fought in that day on the streets of Houston. But what happened after that was that 39 members of that regiment were executed, hung, and more were given life imprisonment. It was a dark day in U.S. history in terms of what happened. Those men were just standing up for their rights and said they'd had enough. So, you know, this is one of those things, and when we look at history and we question what goes on in our history, People could look at these men as men who rioted and did something dishonorable, or you could look at these men at doing the most honorable thing, which was standing up for themselves, their community, and fighting back in a time of gross segregation and lynchings in this country. But that was a very important day in our history. So all people were killed the next day, they were hung the next day, and some were given life imprisonment. It's a very important part of our history that we don't talk about very much that we wanted to share with you on this day as well. And finally, this was a day, if you remember, in 2011, we're sitting in your home here in Baltimore, you remember the shaking going on, and there was an earthquake in Virginia that really kind of shook people up. We didn't realize we were living in that zone, but we are. And this is also the day Muammar Gaddafi was overthrown. But the history books want to say by the National Transitional Council, but they would never have thrown Muammar Gaddafi, whether you liked the man or not, unless the country had was bombed to death by France and the United States and Italy. But that's a story for another day. So that's our day in history this August the 23rd, and a bit of Mark Steiner's editorializing to go along with it. So, so now we move on to the subject of the day, which is the March on Washington. The March on Washington, which was August the 28th, 1963, it was a day that happened 50 years ago when 250,000 people, black and white, men and women, marched together on the Mall to end segregation for jobs and freedom in America, as it was called. We've talked about in the past, part of this march took place because black unions, black labor leaders, pushed and helped organize this march, or it would not have happened, which is why it was jobs. And the Southern Freedom Movement came up under Martin Luther King that pushed it. There was a lot of controversy in that march, People tried to keep SNCC out of it, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, a group that I was part of as a young 17-year-old when I marched that day in Washington. They cut John Lewis's speech back, wouldn't let him say everything he had to say. The Kennedys tried to blunt and stop the march, but they could not. But it was the beginning of the change of Robert Kennedy's consciousness on that day, that he really changed as a human being in the beginning of these next 5 years. So, and we're having a memorial march, a march on tomorrow, 24th, to on the 50th anniversary. I'm going to be there. I encourage everybody to be there, to have their voice heard, to remember that 50 years ago, but to think about what's going on now. So on this show, we're going to start a program off with people who one who remembers that march, one who doesn't remember that march, both who are to reflect on it now. We're going to have young activists coming in after that and then have a conversation with everybody to talk about what this march meant. And in the studio right now is Dr. Katrina McDonald, Associate Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University, Board Member of the Maryland Humanities Council, and author of Embracing Sisterhood, Class, Identity, and Contemporary Black Women. Good to have you in the studio, Katrina.
Great. Glad to be here.
John Milton Wesley is back with us, author, songwriter, senior fellow in social marketing with the National Center for National Behavioral Change at Morgan State University, and a longtime activist and musician. Good to have you back, John.
Good to be with you. Good to be with you.
And you all can join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. I'm about to check our Facebook page. I want to hear your thoughts on the March on Washington 50 years ago and what it means now. John, let me start with you.
Mm-hmm.
You were a civil rights worker.
Yeah,
you grew up
right.
in Mississippi.
Right, right.
The nephew of Fannie Lou Hamer. You
right.
were in the midst of all of it.
Right.
Set the tone for a moment. Your reflections on that time as a young man from Mississippi in the midst of all this.
It was a scary year, the summer of 63. And I moved to Jackson June 12, 1963, the night that Mega Evers was assassinated in Jackson. And it was a very... concerned time for us down there because it was really on the 8 years after Emmett Till had been killed.
By the way, on August 28th, the same day as the march.
Exactly, August 28th, to say that was the day that his body washed up.
Right.
You know? And then for me, I had just moved to Jackson June 12th, and I'd moved away from Roy Bryant and J.W. Milam, who killed Emmett Till. Okay, so now I get into Jackson, and remember, this happened in August of 63.
Right.
And there was a lot of concern because in Jackson, the NAACP, the local groups are organizing and the buses and people are getting ready to do it. But one of the differences between now and then, Mark, was the buzz on the street. See, the march in Washington did not just coalesce around the leaders. The march happened when the people in the streets decided, you know, I'm going to do whatever it takes to get there. People like Dave Avery, who actually hitchhiked, you know, from the South all the way to Washington, and people hitchhiked from across the country. But it was a very frightening time. There was a lot of bombings going on at the time. Remember, we had the little girls killed in Alabama.
Right after the march.
Right after the march. And I guess the best way to describe the time as we knew it was time for the movement to move from the South to the seat of government. And everybody bought into that. Because basically, they failed in Mississippi in what they were trying to do in using the South as a launch pad.
So, and Katrina, as of the generation between.
Yes.
And your reflections as both a professor, a teacher, mm-hmm. someone who's looked at this history?
Well, first of all, while I was very young in 1963, I certainly remember Martin Luther King's death in 68. I was very young. I was shocked. I wasn't sure what I was experiencing, but I knew it was a tremendous thing. And I also remember Robert Kennedy's death. I remember staying up late with my mother to watch him that night on the talk show and then finding him, you know, seeing all the chaos that ensued. So that certainly turned my mind at a very young age to something's terribly wrong, I thought. And so I began to dig more and more, went back to JFK's death as well, did what I could to understand that. And so I grew up highly conscious. And then my mother was a Black Panther, so in Sacramento, California. So I remember as a young girl going to their meetings. And
so you were a movement baby.
I was a movement baby, for sure. And it was very exciting to know that people were committed, you know, to social change. And I was very interested in becoming that as I got older. So as even a teenager, I was always very involved in as much as I could be in terms of encouraging social change. When I think back on all that I now know about that time around the march, I realized just how phenomenal that event was. No mm-hmm. one knew then, right, what we know now. Looking back on it, it has such an impact, probably in ways that it couldn't have had at the time it was actually performed. Nothing has surpassed it in my mind.
Right.
You know, certainly when I watched Barack Obama's inauguration in 2008, you got that flavor mm-hmm. of excitement because of the sheer numbers. But honestly, I don't think anything can ever overshadow that day in 63.
So a couple of things. I mean, as we talked in this program before, in the earlier program we did last week on the coming March on Washington's anniversary and on the march, one of the things people reflected on was no matter what you thought about the march analytically and the fights with Kennedy and the fights between King and Bayard Rustin and A. Right. Philip Randolph and John Lewis and Bob Moses and the people right. of SNCC yeah. and all those battles, all the conflicts
sure.
took place,
mm-hmm. right.
that what happened in the end was a quarter million people hit the mall, and it did have a very deep effect on the movement. It spurred on more activity throughout mm-hmm. the South and then eventually to the North, but throughout the South. So, but I'm curious what you all, when you reflect on what's going to happen tomorrow on August the 24th.
I'll let you go first. But okay.
Really? Okay.
And what you think of the march taking yeah. place. I plan to be there.
Sure.
We are
right.
both going to be there right. to participate in this march. I would say here up front, the Center for Emerging Media, our organization, is one of the partners on this march. So, you know, that mm-hmm. we from the beginning. So, mm-hmm. I have my own mixed feelings about it all, mm-hmm. but I'm curious sure. as to your analysis of tomorrow.
Well, I would Katrina. Love to be there, but as you know, I just got out of the hospital a few days ago. My doctor's not allowing me to march. but I will be there in spirit, and I will be observing it through whatever media is available. I think my thoughts on the march over the last few weeks have been the same kind of thoughts I had just prior to the Million Man March. Now, as a feminist, I stayed away from the Million Man March because I was very frustrated by the focus on gender in that way. But I did watch it here and there on the media, and I was really, really impressed. Really impressed with what they have been able to pull off in these times, right? Mm-hmm. What I was most frustrated about, and I'm sure I would be on tomorrow, is there's no plan for what we do after that, mm-hmm. right? So again, being a social movements baby, my mind immediately goes, well, how can we harness the energy of the day? How do we find out who those people are out there so that we can reconnect with them in their local community so we can start solving problems in constructive ways? That requires us to know each other. And, you know, we see a mass of people. What do you do with that? But today we know we have the ability. We've got all kinds of media that can help us gather information, get people's names, addresses, email addresses, things like that, and begin local dialogue that can then build into a national process. So whatever happens tomorrow, however good it turns out or bad, it's still a moment to seize that I bet nobody's thinking about.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you'd say that, because when I look at who the planners are, and one of the big things going on this time is the National Action Network is mm-hmm. playing a great part.
Al Sharpton's organization.
Al Sharpton's organization. Now, of course, you know, you have the baggage that goes with Al Sharpton. I mean, let's face it, you know. And as a matter of fact, I got a message the other day from Rock Newman saying, well, you know, what do you think about it? Him being touted as a leader. And it was so interesting. It so stunned me when I got the question. I just kind of sat there and looked at it and thought, well, wow, that is kind of interesting. But the idea of who the leaders are, we have the capacity to track and be in contact with the people who were there. But then if you look at these mass movements as they go, I was a copywriter on the Martin Luther King birthday materials, and I remember having the pledge cards and people fill them out and such, yeah. et cetera. I put up a copy of one last year, I think, on my site, just to see if anybody even knew what it was. And most people went, wow, oh, yeah, that was somewhere, but I don't remember what I did with it. So I don't know, Mark.
I mean, there are people who are criticizing this march, saying it's just a tool of the Democratic Party. There are those who are saying that.
Right.
There are those who are criticizing because it's Al Sharpton and Martin Luther King's son, Martin Luther King,
right.
because and the controversy around him.
Right.
On the other hand, there are people like friends of ours and my wife who were saying, we have to go
right.
just to make a statement.
Right.
Well, it's the numbers.
Just to say that this is not – it's an anniversary of – but it's also what comes in the future. It's Trayvon Martin. It's right. the growth of poverty in America. It's people making a statement about
– Exactly.
En masse, and it's yeah. a large group, and that's why the numbers are important. So people can criticize Al Sharpton all day long, right. which, you know, mm-hmm. people
which
do.
Which we can.
Which we can. But it's beyond –
It's beyond
the personalities that are.
It's the visual.
Some people would argue. I would say
right. I think it's the visual though, and you know, I had wished that we had 250,000 people all with T-shirts that said "One Day, One Vote," because that would speak to the Supreme Court decision.
Yes.
Well, right, and that to me is one of the most critical pieces that why some mm-hmm. people are marching, which is the Sherrilyn Ifill wrote. Who's a
very good friend of mine.
Is a good friend of mine as well, and she is a professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law, who's now the head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Thurgood
right.
Marshall's old position.
Right.
And she wrote this op-ed the other day, and she said, why we march. And one of the reasons why we march is what happened with the Voting Rights Act, because right. everything we pushed for in the 60s is there's a huge pushback.
Rollback, yeah.
Right.
To right. nullify it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, I think that for me personally, I have really tried very hard not to downgrade the work of our leaders, whoever
sure.
they be,
right.
whether it's Al Sharpton or anyone else. Even if I disagree with their tactics, mm-hmm. I certainly recognize that they mean well.
Oh, sure.
They mean well. Even as they might, you know, get distracted by other kinds of personal gains that can mm-hmm. be done. So I think they really mean well, and I think that we need to teach the current generation to respect that.
Sure.
And I most want the new generation trained in this. Sure. We can't possibly think that we're going to have any lasting effect on court decisions, on decisions of law and order, anything, unless we have the next generation prepared to carry it forward.
Sure.
as a professor at Hopkins of undergraduates and graduate students, I push all the time for them to learn how to articulate. Let's look back to this era, in the 60s. We had these young guys.
Sure.
Brilliant. Writing and speaking.
Sure.
We had the Huey Newtons and the Eldridge Cleavers. And they knew how to make their statement. And today, I don't know that I could find one student among our students who can step forward, can take an idea. And I'll take, I must.
You're probably going to meet some younger people coming in the next half an hour who would challenge that idea.
But I would love. Every day I'm looking for a challenge.
Yeah.
Every day I look for that challenge because I'm very interested in identifying these kids. I mean, I'm retracting a bit also because my son is actually one of these people that is amazingly articulate on political issues. And he has a friend named Nicholas Brady. My son is Jordan McDonald, his friend Nicholas Brady. They went to City College. They used to sit in Subway on a Friday night, 2 a.m., debating international politics. Mm-hmm. So I know they're there, but they need to, they need to be encouraged. Even when that energy is there, they need to be encouraged to come forward and to bring their ideas to a higher level.
I was reading a piece in a New York Times 2 weeks ago about two young men. One went to Harvard, one went to Yale. They both grew up in Mississippi. And they were talking about the challenge. They grew up in households. They were single parents with their mothers, of course. And then I thought about my friend Eddie Armstrong now, who is a councilman in Arkansas. And I met Eddie in 2002, and we developed a scholarship for kids who would go to the University of Arkansas at Pine Bluff who are from single-parent households. Okay. Because Eddie was came up from a single parent household. I think that there are young people out there who are doing things, and I think it's important that they see us doing what we are doing and that they know that they're a safe porch to exchange this information with. That was the thing that was so significant.
I think that there are a lot of young people doing lots of really powerful stuff in this country right now. And in our last segment, we're going to hear about young people across the country leading the protests and other things they're doing in America. There are young people organizing this community. We're going to hear from them as well. So I think there was a lot going on. And the other thing, when you talk about voting rights, at the march in 63 and during other times, Martin Luther King, who was only 32 years old, we have to remember, on the march. He was 31. He was a young man.
Right.
That he talked about interposition and nullification.
Right.
And when he talked about interposition and nullification, he was talking about voting rights. He was talking about the South states being able to nullify federal laws they didn't want to follow.
Sovereignty.
Right.
Okay.
And so that's part of what's happening again.
Right.
Yeah.
The whole people don't relate to interposition and nullification because it's an older constitutional argument that really had it was the heart of segregation, but it really the same principles are at play now.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So that looking at his speech, because all we ever remember about the march is that one speech, which sometimes annoys
me a lot. It's amazing.
Right.
Yeah.
But he said things that are relevant to this moment
Absolutely.
That we're facing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but when you look back at what happened as a result in 64, if you look at the Voting Rights Act of 64 and you look at 65, okay, and then you come forward to what the Supreme Court did with their decision this year, then all of a sudden you realize that we are really in a state of what I call progressive regression, okay? In other words, we got three steps up and four steps back. Okay, and only a move. One of the senators has said the only way to deal with this is same day voting. That would nullify the Supreme Court's decision.
I would love for you to articulate for the audience exactly what that Supreme Court regression is. I'm not sure.
Right. Well. When you look at the fact that there are certain states, you look at Mississippi, and we have it now with these laws to make it necessary for you to have identification when you come to vote, okay? The truth of the matter is there were certain states who, before this decision was made, they had to actually apply to the federal government to get permission to make changes to their voting rights laws in their states. But now, all of a sudden, you know, Chief Justice Roberts says that times have changed.
Section 4 is no longer necessary, which means Section 5 is nullified.
Section 5 is nullified.
Which is where the power lives.
Which is where the power lives.
So, this is a very serious issue, because what it means is that it's not just the South. You see, it's also exposed that this is not just about the South.
Right.
That's exactly right.
Absolutely. This is taking place in Wisconsin, in Ohio.
See?
In states.
In Ivy League states.
Yeah, I mean, and so
New England states.
This is where there's a bit. Oh, you remember, we have to remember that. I'll never forget that. We have to remember that George Wallace, and the younger generation doesn't remember George Wallace. Maybe some do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But George Wallace, who was governor of Alabama,
right,
stood in the door, would not let black folks in.
Right. So did Ross Barnett. Right.
But George Wallace, when he ran for president all those times, when he ran in Wisconsin, George Wallace got almost a third of the vote.
Right.
So we have to remember that that kind of power of race is not just in the South.
Ah,
it's also in the North.
That's right.
So this voting rights thing has exposed that. We're going to take a very brief break. We're going to switch gears here in a minute. And our guests, Katrina McDonald and John Milton Wesley, will come back in about 20 minutes or so. We're going to begin a conversation with our young folks here and reflect cross-generationally. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. I'll remind you, way back to our conversation on the March on Washington, that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. Or you can log on to steinershow.org and click on their banner. Again, MeQ, Baltimore's Credit Union, MECU.com. The number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Are you going to the 50th anniversary of the march tomorrow? We want to know. If you're not going, we want to know about that too. We want to know your reflections on that march. We want to know your reflections on what you think we need to do today. Where are we today? 410-319-8888. Or write to us at steinershow@gmail.com, 410-319-8888. We are now joined. Other people haven't gotten here yet, but they will be here. Love the Poet is with us. She's back. She's been becoming a regular guest on this show.
Hi.
Indie spoken word artist, a musician, national performance, literary arts scenes around the country. She's author of Black Marks on White Paper, active member of the Speakers Bureau on Poetry for the People at Baltimore, and good to have you back.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So I'm curious. Let me just start by asking this question, two things.
Okay.
As a young woman, clearly wasn't even born when the march happened. Not even close.
Not even a thought. My parents, I think, were in high school still.
All right. Mm-hmm. So, but you knew about it. Everybody knows about this thing, right?
Absolutely.
And most people look at the march as the I Have a Dream speech, is what people remember, right?
Yes.
So I'm curious how you reflect on that moment as a young woman, as a younger person.
Well, for me, number one, being able to speak about it is kind of a dream of mine. I don't know if that sounds strange.
No.
But my birthday is January 16th, 1981. And that's the day after King's actual birthday. So I don't know if that had something to do when I learned that with my almost obsession with what he was about and what the movement was about. But being raised, I was actually born and raised in a town called Columbia, Maryland, which was built to integrate whites and blacks and probably about, 45 years ago.
Right.
And so I've always been, reading and trying to learn more, and growing up in the school system, all you're really taught is Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Harriet Tubman, you know, four people. And so the effect that it has had on myself is just trying to understand the deeper meaning. It wasn't until I attended Coppin and took a higher level African-American history class that I really understood all that went into the march, and that it wasn't just about a really nice speech that the Reverend Dr. King gave, you know, and that it was more so to rally a people who were kind of disillusioned and trying to get them all together and get a fire lit and to get people to be cohesive, because so many people are on so many different pages. And so the effect that it's had on me is just trying I'm having a hard time articulating it, but it's more of a feeling than an actual stamp on, like, you know, it's made me do this, it's made me do that. It hasn't. It's made me feel like, you know, that was a major moment in time, and it helped my generation to not have to necessarily go through that or have to do it again. But I think it's about time for something else major.
Well,
I
remember after Zimmerman was acquitted, mm-hmm. one of the first communications I got
yes.
was from you,
mm-hmm.
where you were so outraged
yeah.
that you didn't know what to do with yourself or how to respond.
I didn't. And then I responded, and people weren't, it wasn't a popular opinion. But, you know, I understand the marching, and I understand that. But to me, I feel like, what kind of effect would that have today? Because even after the March on Washington at that time, even King became very disillusioned with the way things went after that. You know what I mean? So what can we do now that is a bigger statement than just marching, and what is tomorrow going to do?
So we're going to come back to that thought. Uh-huh. That's why I want to explore that. And let me. And Mitchell is our next caller. So Mitchell, hold on 1 second. Mitchell can hear us, right? So Mitchell, hold on. We're going to come to, I really want to get your call, but I want to let Luis have his say. Just walked in the room. Another younger voice. Luis Larin is a leadership organizer with United Workers, originally from El Salvador.
Guatemala,
excuse me, Luis,
that's
from
okay.
Guatemala.
My mother's from El Salvador, so yeah. okay. And my father from Guatemala, so okay. we're good.
This close. And I met Luis many years ago when he first came to Baltimore, and has been working with United Workers. And I'm curious what that march in 63, in your reflections, mm-hmm. mean to you, and what tomorrow means to you, if it means anything.
Right.
This other march is taking place.
No. Well, thanks for having me.
It's good
here
to have
today.
You, Luis. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And you know, the march in 1963 definitely was the beginning of something. You know, and I agree with the there was a historical moment. However, I also have the same question. You know, like what the march tomorrow would do.
Right.
You know, what the are we following the legacy in terms of, like, having marches, or are we following the legacy in terms of the ideology of Dr. King? Mm-hmm. I mean, Dr. King changed radically from civil rights to human rights to mm-hmm. economic equality, mm-hmm. you know, social and economic rights and the distribution of wealth. I mean, he was very specific about, we need to change the way that the distribution of wealth is here, and we need to confront the issues as poverty, you know. And he started to talk very clear about, this is not about African Americans anymore. This is about unite across color lines. This is mm-hmm. about bring Latinos, bring African Americans together, and fight against this cancer as poverty, you know. And so was the beginning of a huge social movement and this revolution of ideas that he talked so much, you know, like there's new ideas, there's a old way to do things, but there has to be a new way to do things. So I you know, as a historical moment, definitely that march is a huge thing, you know, and we need to remember that. But at the same time, for me, is we need to remember what Dr. King was trying to do. You know, it was he just about race, you know, it's really just about race, or he was about something else, you know, because unfortunately, what we hear most of the time is he did this march, he did the I Have a Dream speech, and then we have the, you know, then it was the Voting Rights Act that passed, and then he got killed. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what we hear. That's the story that we know through the mainstream media, you know. And but what happened during all those years? I mean, why he lost so much of the support that he had? Mm-hmm. Because he spoke really clear about, hey, militarism is wrong. Right. Poverty is wrong. Right. You know, racism is wrong. You know, he called them the triple evils.
Right.
And he spoke really clear, really open about that. And after that, then he was killed. But all the history is kind of hidden from us. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not the part that we talk about. We always talk about Dr. King as the leader that won and achieved the civil rights, but not the person that get killed because challenged the system in the most fundamental ways, you know,
absolutely,
which was poverty and which was the issue of inequality, you know, like, mm-hmm, and not just the race inequality. He was very clear about, like, okay, now we can go to, we are able to have access to get into hotels, but we cannot pay for being in those hotels. So why different mix? You
know? Right, exactly.
What doesn't matter. It's not about access. Exactly. It's about equality. You know,
right.
That's
brilliant. That's brilliant.
So what you're saying is important. I really want to explore this in some depth with our callers as well at 410-319-8888 with your thoughts. And we are also now joined by Holly Boas, who is an organizer with Rise Up Texas and the Black Mesa Indigenous Support, who is visiting Baltimore. Good to have you. Good to see you again.
Thank you for having me.
And we had her mic roll up there. And I guess I first met Hallie when you went to see the movie.
I did.
Yes. That we. Why am I blocking the name of the film? Fruitvale. How could I forget that one? Yeah. Fruitvale Station, which is another reason that we have to stand up. That movie was a very powerful movie that everybody was stunned with. But Hallie, welcome to Baltimore. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So tell us also, before we hit our phones here, so Mitchell, thanks for holding on. And the others, please call in at 410-319-8888. Reflect on what this younger generation is saying to us in the studio now. 410-319-8888. Hallie, your reflections on what that march meant to you way before you were born, and what it says now and what tomorrow's says to you.
You know, it's been a really interesting time. I'm actually from the Northeast, and the March on Washington was kind of the seminal event that I was taught as a child about how the legacies of racism and oppression and hatred and greed in this country. And it's kind of been my mission as someone who sees these intersecting systems that are still at play to connect all of our work, especially the work we've been doing in Texas recently. You know, simultaneously when the bills were voted on in Texas, basically abolishing the right for women and all people to access reproductive justice, the Voting Rights Act was simultaneously gutted. So it's all part of the same project, and we really try to connect those all. Mm-hmm. In the work we're doing in Texas.
So let me bring in our listeners and then come right back to pick up on where our new guests came in and bring our mm-hmm. old guests. No, I don't know if it's been age. I'm sorry, baby. I didn't mean it that way. Sometimes I just move too fast with my mouth. 410-319-8888 is the number here as we reflect on the March on Washington 50 years ago and on what's happening tomorrow, whether you're going or not, what it means, and what the struggle for equality and justice means in the 21st century. 410-319-8888. One quick note that I don't want to forget, because I forgot to say it to you earlier in the program, is that Monday at 10:30 on this program, speaking of the struggle against Stand Your Ground and More, Trayvon Martin's mother will be on this program at 10:30 to talk about her fight in the name of her son against Stand Your Ground and More. So that'll be coming this Monday at 10:30. 410-319-8888. Mitchell, you're on the air.
Yes, I would like to respond to something the lady said, whose parents were members of the Black Panther Party. One of the things she said is that the leadership has good intentions, and I think that's a very dangerous thing for us to say about the good intentions of people without a comprehensive analysis of who these people are in the leadership. And that's been a part of the problem of us continue to have the movements moving in the direction we want. Even, you know, Malcolm X talks about how the March on Washington was co-opted. And some of the things he says, just factual, you know, with Whitney White taking over as chairman and this white man taking over as co-chairman to fund the march and other things afterwards. I mean, these are historical facts, but one of the people, the leaders of this march is Al Sharpton, and it's not that Al Sharpton is a leader of black people. He's somebody that controls, helps control the movements to make them stay in a marginal kind of way. And he is a mouthpiece for the Democratic Party, but Al Sharpton has connections under the Freedom of Information Act. These aren't just things that we speculate. You know, he worked to help to get, possibly to go get Assata Shakur back from Cuba. When he ran for mayor, he had a Republican guy who did dirty tricks when Al and Bush Gore was going on. He had him in his campaign. Al Sharpton is a charlatan. And we have not just that he's out in front of people. We have to really investigate and realize who these people are in leadership and where the movement from now on is going.
This is Katrina McDonald, who I believe you were speaking about at the beginning of your statement in regards to my mother having been a member of the Panther Party. My reference to leaders as having good intentions is my attempt to humanize them from some basic level. That is in no way to be misled about who Al Sharpton is at all. And I do believe that probably early in his career he was on the right path, but we know how politics corrupts. And so we certainly have seen some missteps of his time and time again ever since. And I guess I'm hoping that as we go into tomorrow's march, we can somehow package him up in a way that we can kind of ignore whatever problems he's brought to us and focus on what the day means. We can't do anything about the fact that he's leading this thing tomorrow, but we can do what we can to make that event as significant as possible above and beyond anything that he might have imagined. So again, I appreciate what you said. I think what you said is very important to put out there, and we can put a lot of other people on that page. And so I think, again, that we need to try our best tomorrow to put aside our differences and try our best to unite around the most important issues of the day.
I wanted to respond to something that Louise said and probably draw contrast with what the brother was talking about. Whenever I hear the term leader, now, so I think about the African-American community, I am, of course, biased, Mark, I must say. I mean, when your godmother, Fannie Lou Hamer, and Mega Evers was your insurance man, you know, and James Belvoir came to your house every morning, you know, or to, you know, have the opportunity to be in the state of Mississippi when Robert Moses was working there and Charles McLaurin. And my point is that one of the things that we knew about people like Dr. King, people like T.R.M. Howard, who founded the Regional Council of Negro Leadership, people like, Fred Shelsburg, we knew that these people's lives were in danger. This is not about getting television ratings, okay? It was really tantamount to, and to let people understand it, you were really writing a target on your chest, on your face, in Dr. King's point, by taking these kinds of positions. So you did not expect these leaders at that time to always necessarily operate inside the box. Okay? You didn't know what was going to. The greatest fear in 63 was what the crowd was going to do.
Right.
It wasn't so much what Kingley was going to say. I mean, the concern was that many African Americans coming.
Right.
Okay. But in fact, I don't know whether there's any concern whether or not anybody will step out of line tomorrow at all.
Well, when it happened in 63, the 82nd Airborne was waiting. The police were all waiting.
Wow.
They were in the wings waiting for a riot to take place because people thought if you have that many black folks in one place, it's going to be a riot. Mm-hmm. In 1963,
didn't we have an event this week where there were policemen positioned, at the Butler movie?
Oh, what? Yes.
In
Silver Spring. Movie. Exactly.
When there was an audience of mostly African Americans going to see a screening of The Butler, they had police in riot gear.
Exactly.
Outside the theater.
This is why I made the statement, and when I reached out to Mark about what to do next about the Trayvon Martin situation, because this mindset, we have to have law enforcement and to see a movie. This is a problem. Like seriously. Like what can we do to? And this is 2013. You understand? Mm-hmm. You know, I come up from in a generation where we're like, well, we're the first generation to not have to have a movement, to not have to exist in that. You know, because our parents were placed in a nice little class of people and pacified for a minute. And that's how I think about it most of the time. Mm-hmm. And now things are bubbling back up to a head. Number one, because we have a brown president, you know, mm-hmm. and I have never, I mean, if we didn't think that racism mm-hmm. was still in existence.
There it is.
I mean, it has drawn everything to a head. And it's so bad in my mind. You know, yes, it became very covert, very underground. But now things are very overt again. And we are different people at this point. What do we do now as humans who recognize humans for humans?
Let's push that a minute. I'm curious what we're talking about here, what comes in the future, and whether or not, I don't know if the United Workers are going tomorrow. Are they?
We are not sure yet. We have like a lot of things going on right now, you know, but we are trying to push.
But there's no organized effort for your group to go.
We haven't been doing any organizing, unfortunately.
And that's because?
Because we have been working on all this fair development, other work, you know, that in a way embrace what Dr. King did, you know, to bring African-Americans, white and poor people together, you know, and push for real participation, you know. Like, it's really, for us, it's really interesting that the Voting Act, you know, passed in 1965, and now the Supreme Court ruled into, like, another issue that is kind of getting us backwards. And yet, even here in Baltimore, where everyone can vote, or there is no restrictions, how much participation do we really have? You know, it's really, are we still in the time where votes is equal to participation or not? You know, we vote for city council, and yet city council passed the Harbor Point project without, you know, without any consultation, and even with a lot of opposition from the people. You know,
I'm really curious here, because when the Center for Emerging Media, our nonprofit production company, was asked to be part of the sponsoring groups of this march, we said yes. Yep. So we are a sponsoring group of the march on Washington's anniversary tomorrow. On the other hand, I've had some conflicts myself with what this march is saying and what we're doing. I mean, to be there to commemorate it, to be there to talk about, to make a stand, I think is important. To have hundreds of thousands of people in the mall would be a very powerful statement.
Right.
But then what does the state, where the statement go?
Right.
I mean, I think when people marched in 63, there were a lot of movements going on.
Yes. Right.
But the movements had notoriety because you had a center force in 1963 to fight segregation in America.
Right.
So whether you were the more radical groups like we were in SNCC or CORE or the NAACP down south, mm-hmm. or SCLC, King's right. Group, you knew that people were all in a movement to battle segregation. So there's no kind of overarching movement that pulls people together at this moment. So the question, but there's a lot going on. We have a segment coming up in this program at the end of the hour talking about movements around the country and what they're doing to show things are happening all across America. It's not about leaders. Yep. It's about people doing so. So I'm curious how you all relate then to this 21st century, because and where this bridge is between what you're talking about, mm-hmm. Luis, which is this kind of cross-racial class struggle.
Yes. Right.
and the question of race and where they intercede. I'm just curious where you all take this. Let's go around the room. And Louise, Hallie, Love, go.
Okay. Can you repeat the question a little bit more specific? Sorry,
there wasn't a specific. It was pretty broad. I'm asking where you think this. So what is it? Where do you take it from here? I mean, what does that mean? What does this movement mean to you? You're not going tomorrow,
right?
So, but in a broader sense, what is this movement you're talking about? What is this change we're fighting for? Mm-hmm. What do you think it means now for the 21st century that was different when we were your age?
Right. Well, United Workers, as always, we use the line of we are building a movement to end poverty. And that's coming straight from the Dr. King's fight, that he was very open in articulating the issue of poverty. And for us, poverty is something that we are experimenting in the United States in a worse way than in the 1960s world. If we see the inequality mostly, the inequality is growing every single day. It's like the gap between rich and poor is every single day is bigger. And this idea or this fantasy of having a middle class is not real anymore. You don't have any middle class anymore unless you have tons of credit card debt, and so you are not middle class. You are poor. You don't have access to healthcare. You don't have you cannot buy a house. How many foreclosures we just confront, and how many foreclosures are forthcoming. Maryland is suffering one of the most, suffering more foreclosures now than before during the crash, how many people are losing their houses because healthcare, because they don't have access to healthcare? How many people don't have jobs with dignity or jobs, living wage jobs? So, for us, that's the movement, is how we can bring all of those people together, and how we can bring this this fight under the human rights struggle, the basic human rights of live life with dignity. What life with dignity means when you don't have healthcare, when you don't have a house, when you don't have a living wage job, when you don't have real participation in the decisions that how the public resources are spent, that's how we see the movement and coming from the same idea of Dr. King, saying we need to come together. This is not about one race.
We'll take a brief break. We're going to come back, and I want to go right to our other to Hallie and Love and let them comment on this in the 15, 20 minutes we have left in this segment. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner here on WEAA, and support for WEAA is provided by AAA Mid-Atlantic. More information available at 866-4GLASS-1. We are here talking about the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington taking place tomorrow with people who participated in it, people who did not participate in it, young people who are involved in their own movements for fighting for justice and social change in this society. Dr. Katrina McDonald's in the room, Associate Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University. Love the poet, an independent spoken word artist who performs everywhere, doing her one-woman show now, Louise Larin. Leadership organizer with United Workers, Hallie Boas, organizer with Rise Up Texas and Black Mesa Indigenous Support, and John Milton Wesley, author, songwriter, and activist. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Hallie, your similar thoughts.
So it's been an interesting summer in Texas. We've watched the onslaught of the electoral system in Texas basically gutted. Through a vicious onslaught by the Republican Party. And so there's been a massive redistricting campaign. Gerrymandering is rampant. And so that comes plus the dearth of social movements that have been in Texas. And so these past few months of organizing we've been doing is basically comes in, and it's the next it's in response to the next attack on communities. Basically, I think there are five clinics, women's health clinics, for 13 million people in Texas, and they are stripping away every single right that women, trans people, queer people have won in Texas, and bringing us back 50 years. And I think, the passage of these bills in Texas has been in contrast to the widespread participation and support from communities all over the state that we view this as a real opportunity. And the we don't view these issues as a binary issue, as the state and the governing powers try to make it so it's pro-life and pro-choice. And it's we don't see that because the communities that are most affected are the most marginalized. They're poor communities or rural communities. They're primarily Latino and people of color. And that these people are the ones who are rising up. And it's been a really inspiring month in Texas because the people's vision who differ from this draconian, misogynistic attack. And, you know, it's a real seed that's been planted. And I think it's just a representative of many other struggles that are going on in this country.
And what you just said, representative of many other struggles going on in this country. Mm-hmm. So let me hold with the young people just a second here. Just the younger generations. I really want to get this out. So what do you all see as happening in this 21st century? Because it's true. What's going on in Texas is going on in Baltimore, is going on in Mississippi, is going on in San Francisco, is going on in Madison, Wisconsin, is going on in Des Moines, Iowa. It's going on everywhere. There are things happening all across America. Right. So I'm curious where you think this what this movement that you all are part of right now is taking us. What do you think is going to happen? What's your thought about where this is taking America, what it means?
I think that ultimately it's taking America to a place where it desperately needs to go, only if we all can get together on one accord, as we were kind of discussing off the air. We have this massive internet ability. We have this mass media ability, yet everybody seems to still be extremely disjointed. You know, when I look on social media, I look in my newsfeed and I see that everybody is doing something big. Everybody is doing something different. Everybody is doing this and doing that. And I think, in a sense, we may be suffering because of that, we're not seeing that there is a bigger picture being painted. We can't see the forest for the trees almost because everybody's doing something somewhere, but nobody is saying, hey, listen, let me work with you. Let me get with you on this, and then making it a chain reaction kind of situation, mm-hmm. almost like they did for the march when the major organizations got together and said, you know what, I know you have that feeling. Let's not be that radical right now. Let's do this. Let's all compromise and get on the same kind of page. And we have the tools. We just have to figure out. And since the tools are relatively new, the internet is not a very old entity, you know, very new.
Right.
We have to figure out how to get that thing on one accord.
So let me again, picking what you were saying, Louise and then Holly, I mean, so how important is it for you all that your movements are connected or not?
Well, I mean, a movement, you know, that's the key word, a movement. What a movement is, if it's not like different struggles working together, you know, because sure, you need to deal with the immediate issues, you know, like people, what people in Texas is doing right now, because that's what their immediate need versus what Baltimore is doing because of their immediate need. At the end, have the same root, you know, the same root of the system that is copped, the system that is. That is not working for our society, you know, like either for rights for women or either for we fighting for fair development, you know, it's exactly the same thing. We are fighting against exactly the same issues that Dr. King was talking before, you know, in terms of like poverty, in terms of like inequality, why we don't have access to the same things, why we don't have access to good jobs, why we don't have jobs, why we don't have healthcare, why we don't have education or good education, you know. Dr. King was always, when he started with the Poor People, with the Poor People's Campaign, he started with all these issues that we are wrestling now with, poverty, education, good jobs, healthcare, housing, you know.
So are you, like when you're in Baltimore, you're in Houston, I mean in Austin, Do you have a sense of isolation or connection with what's going on around the country?
You know, that's a really interesting question. And I think, actually, I find a lot of connections between our movements. And I think Twitter and Facebook are actually some of the most effective mechanisms for that because people around the world can see what's happening. Right. And I think that the new generation is learning different ways of organizing to bring us all together. And I think It's a learning process, and so none of us have done this before.
Right.
And so we're learning how to do it. And so even, you know, all of us coming on the show and exchanging contacts and friending each other on Facebook and seeing what each other's organizations are doing, that's a step. And I think it hasn't happened before. And so we're kind of making this road by walking it.
Well, one of the things we're doing with this segment that's coming up before the top of the hour with Rose Aguilar, who is a talk show host, a radio host at KALW in San Francisco, and she's looking at movements around the country and brings us stories from all over America about what's happening in different communities. The idea then is to bring people from those communities together to talk together on this radio program to make those connections because is to build something more national. John, very quickly, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to add something. You know, it kind of reminds me of the impact of integration on the movement. And the analysis is that one of the reasons that it was important that the march 50 years ago came to Washington was to bring the movement to Washington, okay, and bring it out of those little isolated states. Okay, so now we have a situation. We have so much social media. Until the movement is that's going on in Texas, I'm reading about it in Washington, the movement is going on in Chicago, Detroit, wherever, you can see it on the Internet. So the question is, why do I need to go to Washington?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, 50 years ago, right. The idea was to bring this focus, we need to bring it out of these hamlets and bring it to Washington. But now, all of a sudden, with new media, it's everywhere. So people are saying, you know, well, I can sit at home and be in Washington.
And watch it on television.
So we have a bunch of people calling in, so we're going to get to them. But one of the things that's interesting here is love them, we're going to go over to Katrina as well, is that the next march on Washington will not be run by Al Sharpton as a commemoration.
Right.
The next real march in Washington is going to be organized by people in this room.
Right.
I
mean, that's...
Yeah,
that's part of what we had to think about, too.
Yeah, I wanted to speak on the question you were asking us about where do we see it going. I actually penned this morning as I was thinking about coming down here today. And I do a lot of my work. I'm an artist, so that's how I get my message out there. And a great poet friend of mine, David Ross, he said to me one time, if we're constantly looking for the leaders, that means we must be the leaders, you know. And so this just came to my mind this morning. I said, I don't think Gil Scott-Heron, when he said the revolution will not be televised, thought anything about the advent of camera phones. Or Malcolm when he said, by any means necessary, knew the means that would be at our disposal. I don't think Huey P. knew that when he said, I'd rather die on my feet than live on my knees, that heroin would create zombies that do that every single day. Or that any of them thought, when they preached strength in numbers, that our armies would exist behind bars and that would be the norm. When Martin spoke about having a dream, he wasn't preaching about racial equality. He was speaking about human equality in a country tailor-made for someone to be born poor and die poor. For the genuine transference of power and not just figureheads working at the will of a ruling few. I don't think Ella Baker had in mind that her SNCC students would fight the good fight only to be pacified in the 80s and herded into a class of people that hardly exist anymore, except for in our minds. We are in the middle. Even our president is in the middle. We are conditioned to ride the fence carefully at all costs at all times. So why, again, are we marching tomorrow? To commemorate a fond memory or to demand transparency about an economy that is just as oppressive today as it was yesterday.
Yeah. Katrina?
Wow, that was great.
Yes, it was.
Thank you.
Beautiful. Well done. With a sense of history, I might add, love.
Yeah.
A good
yeah.
sense of history.
I guess I'm of the mind, and I've pondered this a lot over the years. I respect the fact that there is a lot of political creativity all over the nation, and people focus on different issues. There are those who are adept at articulating issues of poverty, others of race, others of other kinds of deep problems. But I tend to feel that we do need to unite around one issue at a time. Mm-hmm. I think there might be power in that. Mm. If you got everybody thinking about reforming public schools, which is my pet peeve, right? Mm-hmm. let's say for 5 years. Let me say this differently because I might as well put this out. I have felt strongly. I'm a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated. I have not been active in many years. And people say, why? And I said, because I need to be proud of something, you know. Mm-hmm. And I said, what I really want is for all of the, and this is just one piece of a larger thing, all of the black sororities and fraternities for 5 years do nothing but concentrate on reforming public schools. Mm-hmm. Do not have one more cotillion. Okay? See. Do not, what are you doing? What is a cotillion? Why? What? Right? They should be uniting to fight something that they know they can do by their sheer number, right? But, and then other groups, I'm just saying it's just a thought of trying to hone in on one thing that we can change today. And then tomorrow we'll work on something else. So I think in...
But who's going to define that is the problem. Right. Who defines what that issue is?
Right. Well, I think it's not that difficult to define an issue. That's the easy part. Well, is defining
everybody agree
an
on
issue.
One issue to fight about?
No. I'm not saying that's easy. I'm not saying it can be done, I don't think. But I am saying that it can be articulated, and you can, I think there is a way to work at getting people to focus on one major problem that affects us all.
At a time.
So that we can do it. Because I think a lot of times when you focus on so many things, you can't get any of it done because you run out of people and other resources. I'm not saying this is a perfect solution, but it's something that continues to nag at me. How do we get everybody to focus on knocking out a big problem? Then let's knock out another one.
Mm. So, I think that's true about what if we get in one issue, right? And one of the biggest issues that we have in this country is poverty. And poverty is manifested in different ways. It's like you can talk about education, you can talk about healthcare, you can talk about the way that the public resources are spent. And you're still talking about poverty and inequality. And I think the key thing is are we trying to get into one issue or into one of the roots of the problems, because you can, the manifestation of the problems are as the public schools not being good enough or having homeless people. But what are the root of those problems? It's the same root of poverty and the same root of inequality. So we also need to, I think there is a way that we can connect into one big picture that is dealing with the issues that we have, the manifestation of the problems that we have, And I mean, just really quick, for example, the United Workers is part of the Healthcare is a Human Right campaign, which is a statewide campaign that is all connecting with what Vermont did, that they passed universal healthcare. But why we need to pass universal healthcare? Because people are in poverty and they cannot pay for healthcare, and people are losing their houses. And still, what are the roots of this issue? It's just that you have access to a hospital and you don't pay for the doctor, or is that you also have access to a healthy environment? It's also that you have an economic stability. It's just about the healthcare, and that's one of the points that we are making. Last weekend, we met with some of other groups in the Highland Center on the South, and started to work and wrestle with these questions of how we organize, how we come together, how we really start to get that one issue, mm-hmm. But that one issue can be also poverty, human rights.
I'm completely in agreement with you. I'm completely in agreement, but I do think that there are some class people who don't care about poverty.
Well, maybe they need to, though.
They do need to. Exactly. But how to get them to care is the point. How do we get them to care? Because for them, it's outside of their realm. They're living fine.
Right. Yeah.
So we have to get them to understand that it's more than you giving $50 a week to some cause. Yeah. That is about getting engaged in the community, which includes impoverished people.
And we have a lot of people calling in. Let me get some callers in here and also get some emails that have come in as well to get people's thoughts. James Williams Jr. wrote in, "Good morning. I just wanted to know what's up with Al Sharpton bashing. At least he thought to lead this event. Also, what's up with your guests authenticating themselves as quote-unquote having been there as opposed to Al Sharpton? That's the problem. Anyway, that's the problem with us black folks, always differentiating and separating ourselves. Al Sharpton did make some mistakes, but he's always standing up and speaking for his people." So James Williams wrote that in.
Mm-hmm.
And we can comment. Let's go to the phone chain and get some comments. Then we can comment on all of it, all right? 410-319-8888. Bruce, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
Good.
I'm listening to what you're saying, and believe me, I believe in equality and justice, too. But it just seems like on your show, you constantly tell it, and I understand it's a black station, so I understand that you're also talking to the audience. But it's always equality and justice, for people of color, which I agree, they should have equality and justice, but it's just like over and over again, you beat it into it, you bash anybody who's conservative, you bash some of your guests calling and bash white people and make ridiculous, provocative statements. And I, too, don't like Al Sharpton. I think he's a manipulator and a snake oil salesman. I'm not ashamed to say it. I used to be a devout liberal. Now I'm conservative on most issues. And I think the conservatives should have a grassroots movement to push back on some of the nonsense, some of the propaganda.
Well, you do. It's called ALEC, and you've taken over the country.
Boom!
So let me just say that and very seriously, just to respond very quickly before we go to Russ, that we don't – I mean – it's not bashing white people. I'm not going to. I don't bash myself, but I think that if we don't understand the legacy of race and racism in America that has defined this country, that it is always but what is torn apart. Multiracial class movements have been torn apart by race in this country over and over again in our history. The most powerful movements have been the ones where whites, blacks, Mexican Americans and Puerto Ricans and Native Americans have come together to fight together. Those are the movements that have made the biggest change in this country when people have come together. The civil rights movement down south in Mississippi and Alabama, when John Wesley and I were young men in the South fighting, were a movement of white and black people together fighting to make that change.
Right.
The Poor People's Campaign was that change. So, but you have to recognize that the economy of this country, the capitalist economy of America, was built on slavery. If they didn't have the slavery and the trade of slave and tobacco and sugar going back and forth, there would be no modern capitalism. That's what it was built on. Right. And race and creating racism and demonizing a whole community of people, of Africans, was the way to do it. And demonizing Native Americans so we could take their land and say the land wasn't there anyway. It belongs to us now. That's how we built America. So we do have to talk about that. But you also have to talk about class, which is what Luis and others are trying to do on this program to kind of broaden that discussion, which I think is what's critical.
Can I speak real quick on
that?
And
then I'm going to get back to the phone.
Okay. But, yeah. There was I believe it was the Drum Major Effect, one of the King's speeches, where he spoke about having been in the Birmingham jails, and he was constantly there. Mm. And so finally he had built a relationship kind of with the COs, you know, the people in there, and he was talking to one of them. And finally he said to him, "How much money do you make here?" And the guy responded, and King said, "Well, you should be fighting with us and not, you know, fighting against us. You should be fighting with us." And, of course, he was a white man. And, you know, the man kind of looked at him kind of crazy or whatever. But that just speaks to the fact that no matter what color you are, if you are in a lower tax bracket, if you are poor in this country, right, you are oppressed in this country. So it's not just about, you know, and nobody is bashing anybody. It is definitely an issue of class. The only color that matters in this capitalistic society that we live in is green, or whatever color they want to make the money tomorrow. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So let me open the phones here again and come back to Luis and to Hallie and to Katrina, 410-319-8888. Russ, you're on the air.
Greetings, Mark.
Hi, Russ.
Mark, you know, in the 60s, the important thing was voting rights, one of the important things. And there was a purpose for that, because the real power of the people lies in the power of the vote. So what I'm trying to get at here is that in exercising your power of the vote, you need to really make sure that you're not just voting for people because they are one color or another, but because of the color of their ideas. Right is not a color. Wrong is not a color. And what I'm getting at is there's no better example of what I'm talking about than Baltimore City itself. We have an overwhelmingly elected black official administration, overwhelmingly city council president, mayor, city council itself. And yet we find ourselves in a situation where $420 million, $88 million earmarked for poverty programs and empowerment zones is now being given to the richest people in the richest part of the city. Now, if we allow that to happen, what's the sense of marching for votes?
Well, the whole question of voting rights is how that gets changed. And one of the things that when Bruce called in earlier to just reflect on for 10 seconds is that it is the conservative effort of conservative groups like ALEC, funded by the biggest corporations in America, some of the billionaires in America, to change the voting laws, which they did in Wisconsin, which they did in Texas, which they did in Mississippi, which they did in Ohio, everywhere, to keep working and people and people of color from the polls. And that is the reality that is facing when it comes to fighting for voting rights. You were going to say something, Luis and Holly? We're both going to say something?
Yeah, I mean, with the voting thing, you know, like, sure, I guess I'm just going back to the same issue of, like, voting now doesn't mean participation anymore. Because, you know, in voting for the right people, it is more and more a fantasy lately. Because who is funding the both parties? Let's just be clear. Wall Street and the big corporations are funding both parties. So no matter who you vote for, both will do exactly the same thing. They will work for Wall Street. They won't work for us. No matter how many people you vote, no matter how many good intentions you said you have during the campaigns or promises you made, you at the end, you have some debt to pay to who financed your campaign, period. There's no way around, you know. Why we have situations at Harbor Point that was both and done even before it came to the hearing. Why? Because we know that you can vote for as many people as you want, but there is a system, a political and economic system that is set up in a way that no matter how good you want to be, you always will need to end in doing something that is against what you promised. And that's key. That's critical to understand that who is funding. You know, like, you are voting, but you are not electing people, because you vote for those people that are already elected. You know, say, like, okay, here are the two people that you can vote for. But you don't elect those people. You just say, like, okay, who is a little bit better than
so
the other
So you're saying
one?
It's no use to vote at all?
Say what?
Are you saying it's no use to vote?
No, I'm just saying that we also need to remember that we need to create some participation and also some transparency in the system, you know, because, sure, there is power in both, but at the same time, we need to remember that there is no accountability to when those people get to power. There is no accountability processes that we can pursue. You know,
let me say that I do think that your message is that it doesn't pay to vote. Mm-hmm. I think that's ultimately where you're going. I'm not saying that isn't a position one may need to take. Right. I think that if in fact we know these things to be true, and we do. We do know how the system works. We've got to change the system. So voting then should be about changing that system.
Well, exactly.
Voting should be about erecting new laws that keep lobbyists from doing certain things.
Exactly.
I think, you know, because otherwise the truth will remain.
Right. No,
we have to take a very brief break. I'm going to come back from this very brief break. We have like 15 minutes left in this part of our conversation. Okay. We'll go right to Daisy on the phones.
Okay.
Come back to John Wesley, 410-319-8888. So, Daisy, don't hang up. We're coming to your call. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Good to have you with us as we continue this conversation. Let me read a couple of quick emails that come in. Go right to the phones to Daisy. Margaret wrote in that our Govins buses are now full for the March on Washington tomorrow. Thank you very much for announcing them. I heard your announcement on your show. And at any rate, we are now full and raring to go and blah, blah, blah. So she says, I trust you'll be there, and we will be there. And we'll be down very early in the morning. And let me see, there's one more email here at the bottom before we go to the phones and go back to our guests. Is that something? Your vote could send me to California. No, that's something totally different. Okay, no, never mind. So let's go back to the phones. 410-319-8888. Don't need to read that one on the air. Daisy, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Daisy from Baltimore.
Welcome.
Thank you. I wanted to speak to the lady who spoke about one particular issue. I came up during the civil rights movement, and we were part of the whole South that boycotted the buses. And what a lot of people in this generation doesn't understand is that economics played a big part in desegregation. Rosa Parks got on the bus, but we as a black people got off the bus. by getting off those buses, we nearly put the bus companies out of business. That did a lot.
Sure.
That did a lot to make them bring desegregation, because they were losing so much money that we were shutting down that total economy. And to the person who wanted, the teacher who wanted an issue, in 2006, I wrote a letter to the Nike Corporation trying to encourage them to bring some of their factories back here into this country, stating to them that they do target the black population.
Mm-hmm.
If we got behind a company like that, the entire United States black people, and not buy a Nike product or any other company that does not hire black people in this country or any person in this country, these companies will start bringing those jobs back over here. We have got to start using our economic strength. That was a part of what Martin Luther King was talking about in Washington in 1963.
That's true.
And a lot of people, the general government put out that the march was only about sitting next to a white person. That was not the whole issue. The whole issue was that we were being demonized. We were being let out of the economy, but we also had the power and our money.
Right.
And what some of the white people who are calling don't understand is they have lost the jobs now, too. And it all comes down to economics.
Mm-hmm.
And we have got to get back to the economics. And I hope that the young Spanish person on that show does understand that he needs to be in Washington tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Daisy, thank you so much. Let's come back to that last comment you made to Louise, but
yeah,
very quickly.
Yeah,
then we'll go to
Louise. I wanted to just comment on what Louise said. One of the things, and this lady made the connection between the buses and the impact on economics. We understood the role the Interstate Commerce Commission laws played back then. I mean, there's a reason why the civil rights workers were on buses.
Well, she was talking about the Montgomery bus boycott, though. But
I know she was talking about the Montgomery, but they also knew that if they dealt with the buses, they could affect the economy. But I also want to just come back to something that he said, because I want to talk about bringing this thing back to Baltimore. You see, it's so interesting. What about if, say, 20 years ago, when we were dealing with what the changes over in East Baltimore, what became EBDI.
Mm-hmm.
You see, at this point now, as this thing marches toward the harbor, now you're going to have Harbor Point. You had Johns Hopkins to turn their direction from Broadway east and west. Now it's going north and south, okay? So that's going to go march right down, and it's going to butt up against Harbor Point, okay? If you look at what's going in terms of the University of Maryland as it moves west, okay? So, but we did not see the connection, and people were not given by these leaders, and I don't mean this with malice, but of course, that could not be a real crowd behind what Carl Stokes was trying to do in slowing down Harbor Point, because the people were not sufficiently
educated
as to what it meant.
Exactly.
Okay, so you can't blame the people if they don't know. They didn't see the connection 20 years ago. But now, as it comes up on them, they can see the fact that only $3 million is going to be invested in housing, you know, for poor people. Okay, so, but I think that these are the kinds of things when you talk about how you can make the connections. People need to know the connections,
right,
how all of these things work together.
Yeah, you have to help them draw it out.
Parallels.
Yeah.
So, coming back to the march tomorrow, last thing that Daisy said was to Luis, we hope you go to the march tomorrow. So I'm curious, in this room, are we going to the march tomorrow? Is it important to do? I'll start by saying, yes, I'm going, because I think that it's important to make a statement with as many people as you can in Washington, D.C., that there are people who care. It's not about Al Sharpton or MSNBC or the Democratic Party. It's about standing up and saying we have to have a new America because we have something we're fighting for here. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious what we think.
I think it's very important for people to go. I've mentioned already that I would love to go, but medically I'm not allowed to go.
I do plan to go. I did tell you guys that I didn't know much about it. I didn't hear much about it. But I do plan to go for multiple reasons, and just show some solidarity, even though I feel like much more action needs to happen.
Sure.
Real action, though.
Hallie from Texas.
I completely agree with you. I actually wish I had known I have another engagement that I have to go to, but it is definitely going to be a commemoration of and moving forward with our collective history.
Mm-hmm. Well, I could say that I'm going. Of course, I must say that I am prejudiced in the reason I'm going. My little sister is coming here from Mississippi, and I'm going down to be with her at the march. So, but I was conflicted before that. I must admit. Mm-hmm. But she came all the way from Mississippi to do this, and I'm
going. You were conflicted about going.
I was conflicted about going.
I've
been conflicted as well. The way I'm going, yeah. I've also been conflicted about it as well.
I want to say this on the air that the driving force for me to go is my sister is taking my nieces. They are now getting ready to be 12 and 9. The 12-year-old was born the day before 9/11. And so she only lived 24 hours before the world was completely changed.
Sure.
And I want to see them. I want to see their reaction. I want to educate them on why they are even there. And I want to be there to take pictures and to see how they react, because they are our future. Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's very relevant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I think, I think like as a way to remember where we come from, that's critical. But I think that we have so much work to do before we can say the revolution start, you know. And this is we are not at that place. We need to organize, we need to do what Dr. King said, which was organize, you know. We need to educate more people and develop more people and raise the awareness. You know, one of the biggest issues that we have in the society is that people are not liberated from themselves. They still thinking that everything is just black and white, and they are not seeing them as part of the situation. People don't recognize themselves as poor people, and a lot of that is because it is a shame to say I'm poor, right? Because for many years. Being poor is connected to being lazy, right? And is connected with it's your fault. It's not that the system doesn't work. It's it's your fault. And so I think like there is a need to do way more work before we can say, let's go to Washington. Let's change the things radically, you know, because that's what we need. We need like that revolution of values that Dr. King talked. That revolution of values is not there yet. We are in that way. Yes, we are developing the conscience. Yes, we are creating more and more awareness. Yes, but we need to do more work to be able to change that.
Well, tomorrow is really an act of symbolism. Right. Sometimes I think symbols are important. So,
I keep saying it's the visual.
So let me go to the phones and see what folks are thinking. 410-319-8888. Last couple thoughts on the air here. Victor, you're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Very well.
I was just good hearing the comments and whatnot. But what kind of got into my spirit was the March on Washington was like another redo. I went to the first march. I was a kid then. And I seen change. But the redos, I mean, there was an agenda. There was an agenda. And what we lost the agenda, what we got to scream again and for a new agenda. The agenda's still the same. It's change. And what we're not doing is we're not activating change. When I was in Europe, they said, I lived in Europe for a couple of years, and they said, the only thing about America, they never finish anything. We don't finish anything. We got so many things on our itinerary, but we never finish anything.
Back to what you were saying.
So I just wanted to make that statement, man. And then, you know, I hope, the redo, man, it's a redo from the 60s. What, so when my grandchild grow up, another redo?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, let me just kind of push back a little bit, Victor, and see what our guest thinks, since our next guest hasn't arrived yet, so we can talk a little bit more before she gets here, okay? Mm-hmm. Is it a redo, or is part of the history of struggle that things do change? I mean, things changed. Mm-hmm. Segregation ended. Voting rights was voted in. movements began. Women's movement began to change the nature of being a woman in the society. Mm-hmm. The environmental movement was created in that period that has created environmental consciousness, still fighting to against the pipeline and to make people aware of what's happening to our earth. I don't know if we can say that we are at a place where things are the same. And there's been a lot of pushback by the right to stop, and by big money, to stop the movement to stop what was created. So I don't know. I think that things have changed, but the step is how we take it to the next step.
Right.
I think we do have our next guest here. I want to thank, this has been a really good conversation. You all have been great. And we'll come back and do more of this in our dialogues here in Baltimore and around the country with people in movements to see what we're going to change. My dear old friend John Milton Wesley, good to have you in the studio.
Good to be with you, Mark. Good to be with
always,
you.
Always, Dr. Katrina McDonald. Glad you could join us for 2 hours. Good to have you here as well.
Wonderful being here.
Michelle Antoinette, a.k.a. Love the Poet. We'll be talking to her soon about her one-woman show coming up. Good to have, I see it right there, God's Country, and we'll be talking about that in the coming weeks.
Awesome.
Luis Lorin, United Workers. Good to have you in the studio, brother.
Thanks.
And
Mark, I'll be back at the Avenue on the 7th, too. Avenue Bakery.
And the Avenue Bakery on the 7th of
September.
We'll get on that. We'll get that on the air, too, before you get there. And Holly Boas, organizer of Rise Up Texas. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having us. Thank you. And for all the interviews that you you did with us in July.
Yeah, it was good to have you all here.
And Mark, can I just finish with one quote from Dr.
King? Very quick one, though, because we
really
have to take a break.
Just a quick with Dr. King. You know, like, I think, like, the I Have a Dream has been, like, to commercialize that we forget all the other things that he said. And this is one of the most powerful quotes that I have from Dr. King. The dispossessed of this nation, the poor, both white and Negro, live in a cruel, unjust society. And they must organize against injustice, not against the lives of persons who are their fellow citizens, but against the structure through which society is refusing to take means which have been called for and which are at hand to lift the load of poverty. There are millions of poor people in this country who have very little or even nothing to lose. If they can help to take action together, they will do so with freedom and power that will be a new and unsettling force for our completion national life. So just to remember, that's organizing, and that's what we need to also do.
Luis Lorin, thank you so much, brother.
Thank you.
We're taking a very 10-second break. Come right back with Rose Aguilar. Stay with us.
Awesome.